This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Welcome to the special KBOO live broadcast. Good evening, everyone. Well, this is the second in a series of six live broadcasts of the 2013 ILHI Lecture Series. I am Del Crescenzo, host of Bread and Roses, and I'm here with...
I'm Jimmy Tardy, the co-host of Occupy Portland Radio, and tonight's speaker is Buck Parker. Buck is the strategic advisor for Earth Justice. We're broadcasting live from the First Congregational Church in downtown Portland.
And KBOO is a proud media sponsor and so pleased to be airing the entire 2013 lecture series. Again, this is the second in a series of six, and this year's series is entitled Who Owns Who and What You Can Do About It.
That's right. Tonight's speaker is a native Oregonian, Vauder Buck Parker. We'll be speaking tonight on Who Owns Our Environment.
And I feel that because the series is really focused on solutions as well, I think that this is one of the reasons why Buck is here tonight, because he has ideas about who actually owns the environment and what we can do about it. And he has been involved for years and years. I think since 1980s, he's been involved with the Earth Movement, and he's now the executive director of Earth Justice.
That's right. He was the executive director during the George W. Bush regime, and I think now actually he is a strategic advisor for issues in the Arctic. And if I remember correctly, he's trying to work on projects that'll mitigate the damage in the Arctic from climate change and oil and land development. That's Buck Parker. He's talking to us tonight as part of the ILHI series. ILHI, an ancient Chinook word to describe earth, ground, land, country, place, or world. And they are taking on quite a broad range of issues in this series.
Absolutely. And I want to tell you a little bit about something that Buck Parker was involved in. In 1971, there was a handful of young lawyers who were really angered over what they felt was blatant misuse and abuse of the nation's environmental treasures. And so they decided to use conservation law to take action against the outrages, to take action so that they were able to make a difference. They were really upset about the issues around natures and what they were witnessing. I think there's this beautiful quote that was actually laid out on the ILHI website. By the way, if you are interested, you should go to ILHI.org to find out more. And here we are going to go in just a second to Peter Shoemaker introducing Parker.
And welcome to the second talk in the 2013 ILHI series. We're looking at several systems: food, environment, media, finance, and government, that are no longer just issues. They are complex challenges. They've become commodities that are increasingly influenced, even owned by a small subset of society. And I want to thank, first of all, our board, our sponsors, our volunteers, all of you for coming and supporting the ILHI lectures, and in particular, Portland State University Institute for Sustainable Solutions, Stoll Reeves, the Heathman Hotel, and the Lazar Foundation. I want to thank them in particular for their support. We began last month with author, activist, food policy expert, and excellent Bollywood dancer, Raj Patel. Tonight, we'll look at who's making the environmental policy sausage with Buck Parker. And then in March, we'll look at current trends in media with Center for Media and Democracy founder John Stauber. And then in light of the recent and ongoing and probably future banking and finance crisis, we'll have former Wall Street banker and housing commissioner Catherine Austin Fitz provide an insider's view of that industry. And then finally in May, author and attorney Jeffrey Clements will speak about the recognition of constitutional rights for corporations via Citizens United versus the FEC. In addition, next week, I want to let you all know that we're there's a in my evenings, I guess, we have speakers over at Pacific Northwest College of Art, and we'll have Jeffrey, or we'll have Christopher Phillips, who has written Socrates Cafe and Constitution Cafes. We had him here a couple of years ago, so he'll be at PNCA, Pacific Northwest College of Art, Northwest Johnson and 13th, 7 p.m. next Friday. And Christopher is he's a wonderful speaker and a wonderful thinker and proponent of the Constitution as a living document. So I highly recommend that you come to that. And then also over at Pacific Northwest College of Art, April 2nd, we'll have Pam Dixon from the World Privacy Forum, who will be talking about who owns our digital life and kind of designing our digital life. Anyways, you go home tonight, think about friends and colleagues, as I always encourage you do, you'd like to invite here and hear the good news about who owns us. Hopefully that news is, we are our own owners, but there are maybe others that might disagree. We'll put this up on our website, and we'll send emails out to everybody. And hopefully you can join us for the rest of these events. A little housekeeping before we begin tonight. Question and answer as usual. I'm going to give you my usual admonition that for the most part, we're here to hear the speakers versus ourselves. We do want questions, but the usual admonition that a really, really long statement that kind of verges on a dissertation followed by, don't you agree? It's probably not a question. The last little part is, but it's not really a question. So short, succinct, and let's look for the wisdom of our speaker. So, speaking of our speaker, Buck Parker is a native Oregonian, a sometime and future resident of Hood River. He left here in 1980 to work with Earth Justice on just a short little, 2-year stint, and 30 years later, he's still with Earth Justice. He was first a litigation coordinator and then executive director from 1997 to 2007. In 1989, Mr. Parker established Earth Justice's international program, which focused on the intersection of human rights and environmental concerns, and now encompasses trade issues as well. During his tenure as executive director, he greatly expanded Earth Justice's legislative and communications staff and led the organization during the critical years of the Bush administration. He now holds the position of strategic advisor, working on special projects at reducing environmental damage, particularly in the Arctic, caused by climate change and industrial activity, especially oil and gas development. In addition to holding a bachelor's in history from Stanford, Buck Parker is a graduate of Harvard Law School. Please welcome Buck Parker.
Thank you, Peter, for the kind introduction. And it is a pleasure to be here this evening, not least of which is the pleasure of knowing that next year I'll get to sit in the audience and hear the lectures, because as Peter mentioned, my wife and I are moving back to Oregon after a 2-year absence that got extended to 33 years. Oregon and the Northwest have never really lost their allure for us. I say that you know that somebody has the Northwest in their bones when they smell wet wool and get all nostalgic. When I was asked to speak this evening, I was told that the title of the talk would be Who Owns Your Environment? And I thought to myself, well, that's going to be a pretty short talk. You do. But you have a very serious problem with your managers. It's not, however, the first time that I have spoken at an ILAHI-sponsored event. In 2005, ILAHI and Reed College sponsored a series of lectures at Reed, and I was invited to speak then. And I thought it would be interesting to go back and review what I had said at the time and see how it held up. So, for those of you who have been kicking yourself for 8 years for having missed Reed, here's the little recap. I talked about the fact that science had become politicized. I criticized the efforts made by some industries to create the impression of scientific uncertainty, particularly around issues of causation, to stave off legislation or regulation that would affect their products and business practices. I also talked about the efforts of some of the same industries and politicians to muzzle scientists working for government agencies or in publicly financed institutions who were saying things that those industries or politicians didn't want to hear. My point was that we, the public, as well as scientists, need to be very vigilant to protect the integrity of the information on which we base our moral and political decisions. As I looked at the talk, I didn't see anything that I wouldn't say today. It held up pretty well. In fact, that was the whole problem. It held up too well. 8 years later, all the problems I talked about are still with us, and the talk isn't nearly as dated as I would like it to be. But as I looked at it, I thought, to a serious extent, I had pulled my punches. First, I didn't really talk about climate change or global warming, and I use those terms interchangeably. I noted that Hurricane Katrina had hit Louisiana just weeks before the talk, and this had raised questions about the connection between an extreme weather event and climate change. But I did not drive home the point that it was in the area of climate change that this technique of artificially manufacturing a controversy to create uncertainty was perhaps having its most damaging effect. The notion that climate change may be happening, but we cannot show that there is any link to carbon dioxide. Second, I didn't link what I was saying to what was happening in the political world more broadly. I talked about the key role that science plays in implementing environmental laws, and I talked about attempts that were then being made in Congress to undermine those laws and the scientific procedures that support them. What I didn't say was that all of those efforts to weaken environmental laws were being led by Republicans. And I ignored entirely the complete transformation that has taken place in the Republican Party's position on environmental laws over the last three decades. So tonight, I want to fill in those gaps. I want to explore a little of the history of the Republican Party with respect to environmental issues so that you can appreciate the magnitude of the change that has taken place in our political dialogue. And then I want to talk about what that may mean in terms of climate change. My fear is that the polarization of the parties but especially the changes that have taken place within the Republican Party, is going to cause us, all of us, not just Americans, but the world, to lose our last best chance to slow and perhaps lessen the worst impacts of climate change. It's a cheery evening you're in for. I'm speaking for myself tonight, not for my part-time now employer, Earth Justice, or any other environmental or other organization that I'm associated with. Some of what I say will sound partisan, but it's not meant to be. It's simply no secret that Republicans have chosen to position themselves as the party opposed to government action on climate change. And with the exception of some details, I'm probably not telling you anything that you don't know. But while the folks in Washington are devoting all of their political attention and energy to an unrelenting grudge match over the budget and deficits, a deficit, by the way, that is shrinking even as we talk, we are in danger of missing an unexpected opportunity to actually do something useful about global warming. Now, I know that there are registered Republicans who believe climate change is a very serious problem and that the United States and other countries have a duty to do something about it. But few of those are office holders. For the most part, the Republican Party's office holders are divided between those who deny that climate change is happening at all and those who acknowledge that it is happening but choose to disbelieve or even attack scientific explanations. Take, for example, Mitt Romney. Now, when Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts, he was something of a climate activist. He frequently spoke about climate change, emphasized that human activities were at least a contributing factor, and argued that the United States should be using its resources to do something about it. He pushed to close older, inefficient coal-fired power plants and encouraged the development of renewable energy. He appointed people to his cabinet and government who had strong environmental credentials. Doug Foy, a staunch environmentalist who had founded and led the Conservation Law Foundation of New England, was one of those. And another was Gina McCarthy, whom President Obama is reported to be about to appoint to replace Lisa Jackson as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. In 2004, Romney's administration drafted a climate action plan that led to the country's first interstate compact to reduce greenhouse gases, the Northeast Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. But something happened along about 2005 when Romney decided to make his first try for the Republican nomination for president. He reversed course on his own climate action plan proposal and refused to sign on to the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. From then on, through his second successful try for the nomination, Romney found it necessary to take much more ambiguous positions on climate change. He began to express doubts about the causes of climate change, to question the state of the science, and to make fun of proposals to limit fossil fuel use. Ultimately, he reversed course completely and promised that a Romney administration at the national level would help the oil and gas and coal industries by paring back on environmental regulations that were preventing their expansion. My point actually is not to pillory Mitt Romney. He's hardly the first politician to change his position on an issue when the old position became a liability. And leaning to the left or to the right in order to get your party's nomination is something of an American political tradition. My point, though, is that Romney abandoned his climate change position because he knew his party, that regardless of where the broader electorate might be, an activist position on climate change and possibly on any other environmental issues could cost him the nomination. The conclusion that the Republican Party has become anti-environmental and even anti-science does not hang on the case of Mitt Romney alone. Here are a few more examples to add to what you can read every day in the newspapers, magazines, and blogs that cover politics. In 1995, three Republican activists formed a group called Republicans for Environmental Protection. Republicans for Environmental Protection was to be a rallying point and base from which pro-environmental Republicans could advocate for a stronger Republican position on environmental issues. Interestingly, Republicans for Environmental Protection recently changed its name. It is now called Conserve America. The reasons the organization gave for doing that was that having Republican in the name was too limiting. Too many people who think of themselves as conservatives and are interested in environmental issues no longer think of themselves as Republicans. It is a lot easier these days to be a conservative environmentalist than it is to be a Republican environmentalist, and there are probably more of them. Another example is Sherry Bollert. Some of you may know that Sherry Bollert was a congressman from upstate New York, Republican, who served in the House from about 1995 to 2007 and made his mark as a champion of the National Science Foundation and for more funding for federal research in science and education. In a blog written last month, Bollert decried what he called the Republican Party's increasingly extreme positions on science and the environment, and an increasing tendency within the party to deny that environmental problems exist, and even to launch personal attacks on scientists who do research on them. Although the Republican shift to the right on environmental issues has been taking place in general over a long period of time, on the climate change in particular, it has occurred very quickly. Here's what the Republican Party platform had to say about climate change in 2008, just 6.5 years ago. The same economic activity that has brought freedom and opportunity to billions has also increased the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. While the scope and long-term consequences of this are the subject of ongoing scientific research, common sense dictates that the United States should take measured and reasonable steps today to reduce any impact on the environment. Those steps, if consistent with our global competitiveness, will also be good for our national security, our energy independence, and our economy. Then went on to say that a Republican Party should promote technology-driven, market-based solutions that will decrease emissions, reduce excess greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, increase energy efficiency, and mitigate the impact of climate change where it occurs. That language completely disappeared from the party platform of 2012. Instead, the 2012 platform flatly opposes, and I quote, any and all cap-and-trade legislation. Cap-and-trade legislation, of course, was what the party's 2008 nominee, John McCain, had been pushing for. The platform also said that a Republican Congress would take quick action to prevent EPA from moving forward with new greenhouse gas regulations. And finally, the platform took a swipe at the integrity of climate scientists, calling for restoring scientific integrity to our public research institutions and removing political incentives from publicly funded research. Gone are any proposals, positive proposals, for dealing with climate change, or even any acknowledgement that's a real. It's simply out and out opposition. At this point, I'm reminded of a story told to me a few weeks ago by an acquaintance of mine whose job has taken her on prolonged assignments to various places all over the world. One of those was to Bergen, Norway. And so she moved to Bergen, and for the first 3 or 4 weeks, it seemed like, in fact, it didn't seem, it did. It rained every single day. And one day she was in the grocery store and she was checking out. And she said to the checkout clerk, "Does it always rain like this around here?" And he looked at her and he said, "I'm just 16. If you were 16 or 26 or even 36 and looking at the Republican position on environmental issues, you could be forgiven if you wondered whether it was always that way. It's not the case, and it's not the case by a long shot. And you don't have to go all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt to find Republicans who were very strong environmentalists. No, there was a time, not that long ago, and when concern for the environment was bipartisan. Take a look at some of the better-known federal environmental legislation coming out of the late 1960s and 1970s. The National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, the act that created the EPA and also environmental impact statements. Although its architect really was Scoop Jackson, the senator from Washington State, it passed the Senate unanimously by a voice vote and with only one dissenting vote in the House of Representatives. President Nixon willingly signed it into law. The Clean Air Act of 1970 established the basic system that we have in place today for controlling air pollution. It again passed the Senate unanimously and passed the House by a vote of 374-1. It was also signed into law by President Nixon. The 1990 amendments, now we're talking about a time closer to us, that strengthened the Clean Air Act and also passed both houses of Congress by a significant majority from both parties, and those amendments were signed into law by President George H.W. Bush. The Clean Water Act of 1972, which established essentially the structure we now have for controlling water pollution, has a slightly more interesting but still strongly bipartisan history. The Clean Water Act passed both the Senate and the House with majority support from both parties. But Nixon vetoed it on the grounds that it would cost too much. The bill went back to the House and Senate. Both houses reenacted the legislation by the two-thirds majority needed, and it became law. Interestingly enough, one of the senators who voted for the act was James Buckley, whom some of you may remember was the brother of William F. Buckley, and not a member of the Republican Party, but of the Conservative Party of New York. But get this, think about it. In 1972, it was possible for a William F. Buckley-type conservative to vote in favor of a strong conservation law that had been vetoed by a Republican president on the grounds that it cost too much. In fact, he not only voted for it, Buckley was a sponsor of the legislation in the Senate. And then finally, there is the Republicans' bete noire, the Endangered Species Act. The bill Republicans now love to hate passed the Senate by a voice vote in 1973, and passed the House by a vote of 355-4. President Nixon signed it into law. Congress passed strengthening amendments to the Endangered Species Act in 1988, both times by voice votes, and President Reagan signed them both. Now, some of the earliest votes can be explained by the fact that they probably didn't know what they were doing. But that's not true of the later amendments. Those in the 1980s and even the 1990s that still drew strong bipartisan support. And let me point out, as probably you know quite as well as I do, that Republican support on environmental issues and dealing with them was not confined to the federal level. The best known example I can think of is Oregon's environmental law and political football, Senate Bill 100, that established the land use planning system. We normally think, or often think, of Tom McCall, a Republican governor, as being the person behind that bill, and he did support it. But the person who did the really heavy lifting was Senator Hector McPherson, a dairy farmer and Republican from Linn County, who was motivated to protect the state's rich environmental and agricultural heritage. So what happened? How or why did it get to be this way? People have written whole books about the changes in the Republican Party and also about the polarization of American politics more generally. This is not an area in which I have any particular expertise, but I have given a lot of thought to it in a specifically environmental context, asking myself why such a strong, even virulent, anti-environmentalism should take hold within the Republican Party and its messaging. Some of it, of course, is obvious. The Republican Party has generally positioned itself as the more business-friendly of the two major parties, and as the party more opposed in principle to the enlargement of government powers. Environmental laws do generally require more government, not less, and almost by definition, they restrict business activity as well as individual behavior. That would explain a tendency to be more skeptical about many of the statutory prescriptions for environmental problems, and a greater faith in business and individuals to regulate themselves. But that is not particularly new or dangerous, and might sometimes result in better legislation. And it's a far cry from denying that problems exist or attacking scientists. I think one of the things that is different now is the growing awareness of climate change threatens some businesses, primarily those that are based on fossil fuels, in a way that they have never been threatened before. If it were merely a matter of installing pollution control devices, there would be a lot of complaining, but the costs would eventually be passed on to the consumer. But when we're talking about reducing carbon dioxide emissions, we're not talking about emissions controls. We're talking about severely cutting back certain industries or even eliminating them altogether. And at that point, some of the players get a little panicky. It has definitely raised the stakes, and I suspect that there is a lot more money going into the anti-environmental message now than was the case in the past. But anti-environmentalism, I think, has also proved to be a uniting message with some other important Republican constituencies. One of these is the small but very vocal libertarian wing, for obvious reasons. These folks are probably not so pro-business as anti-government and anti-regulation, and so the environment and environmental laws and regulations are an easy target. But I think it's the usefulness of anti-environmental and anti-science messaging to the Republican Party's religious constituency that gives that message much of its attraction. Republicans do not attack science and the environment so much as they denounce scientists and environmentalists. Scientists who warn of climate change are either working from biased data or engaged in a broad conspiracy or hoax designed to get more government grants. Environmentalists are either innately biased toward big government or, and here's where I think it gets really interesting, practitioners of some sort of earth-worshipping pagan religion that denies the existence of God. You don't hear that a lot in the Pacific Northwest, but there are other parts of this country where you hear that quite a bit. I don't argue that this was all carefully thought through at the very beginning, but I think it's no accident that anti-environmental, anti-science messaging has took such a firm hold as the Republican Party implemented its Southern strategy to win over Southern Democrats to the party, and its somewhat less geographically focused effort to reach out to the religious right. The biblical literalists, who, let us remind ourselves, are not necessarily the same as evangelical Christians, many of whom are very concerned about climate change. But the biblical literalists already have their own issues with scientists, and especially with geologists and evolutionists. So casting doubt on the integrity of scientists is a way of putting the Republican Party on the side of the religious right, even if the party can't go so far as to denounce science as such. And suggesting that those science-friendly environmentalists are in fact pantheists or pagans is for some a pretty easy next step. There's another dynamic at work here, too, that makes environmental laws such a juicy target. The effectiveness of environmental laws depends on their enforcement, ultimately by the courts. And it's no secret that environmentalists have frequently turned to the courts to ensure that environmental laws are followed. Anti-environmental messaging thus dovetails nicely with another key Republican message, the fulmination against judicial activism, the charge that federal judges are ignoring the Constitution and statutes and are making law willy-nilly on their own. For some reason, this criticism doesn't apply to decisions, Supreme Court decisions about presidential elections or campaign finance, but that's another story. And finally, I suspect that there's a darker side to the messaging. In some circles, charges of judicial activism draw an especially strong response because they remind some people of the role of the courts in ending segregation. And in those circles, Republican candidates do themselves no harm by lumping environmentalists together not only with scientists, but with federal judges. In short, regardless of whether the speaker believes it very deeply, anti-environmentalism has simply become almost too good a messaging point for a lot of Republicans to resist. And it means that environmental concerns, like almost everything else, have been drawn into the black hole of partisanship that seems almost impossible to escape. This extreme partisanship has serious environmental consequences. Discussion of even reforming laws that may need improving are stymied because environmentalists don't want to run the risk that reform will mushroom into attempts to gut a statute altogether. New legislation of any sort is practically a dead letter. For instance, although the executive branch implemented a number of the suggestions made by the President's Commission on the Deepwater Horizon oil spill for changes in regulatory agencies and restructured somewhat, Congress has not acted on any of the recommendations for changes in the law. True, right after the spill, some of the proposals did make it through the House, but they died in the Senate. And since then, no one has even bothered to reintroduce them. There's simply no point in doing so in this political climate. The ideological extremism has gotten so bad, in fact, that it has become impossible for Congress to take action even where virtually everyone who counts is in agreement. A particularly good example, I think, is the failure of the Senate once again in 2012 to ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty. Now, the Law of the Sea Treaty, which was negotiated in the 1980s, describes procedures, outlines, or sets up procedures for resolving disputes over jurisdiction over the outer continental shelf. It sets up procedures for mining the deep seabed, contains some general language, environmentally protective language as well. Initially, President Reagan had some objections to it, but the language was changed to meet those objections. Since then, the treaty has had the support of every president, Republican or Democratic, H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and now President Obama. It has the support of every living Secretary of State who has served under any of those people, and some who served under Reagan and Nixon, even. But we are still unable to get that ratified. It has the general support of the environmental movement. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has practically beseeched Congress, or the Senate, to ratify the treaty, saying that it's a security issue and that it also opens up opportunities for U.S. business. Nevertheless, in 2012, this last year, when it once again came before the Senate Republicans, 34 Senate Republicans led by Jim DeMint, refused to vote for ratification of the treaty and said simply that it would impinge national sovereignty. So here you have a situation where everybody, from business to environment to several of the sort of right-wing think tanks, say this is a good thing, and we still cannot manage to get it ratified. When I began, I said that I would link all of this up with climate change. Those of us in the room who are not convinced that the overwhelming majority of scientists who study climate change are engaged in a vast fraudulent conspiracy to get more government funding are concerned about climate change. Rapid climate change threatens to drive many plant and animal species to extinction and severely disrupt stable weather patterns, ecosystems, and watersheds. It will, in all likelihood, increase the frequency and intensity of destructive storms. It will change temperature and precipitation in predictable and unpredictable ways. It will make agriculture much riskier, destabilize water and food supplies, dislocate people, put pressure on international borders, and probably bring down some governments. It will cause sea level rise, requiring either massive relocation efforts or huge construction projects, either of which will impose financial burdens on governments, businesses, and individuals, and threaten funding for almost any other government activity except the military. If you care about education, about health care, about immigration, about peace, and certainly about the environment, or any other issue, you have to be worried about climate change. It's a disaster, and it's not a disaster that's waiting to happen. We're well into it, but not nearly so far into it as we're going to be if we don't take concerted national and international action very, very soon. Now, as probably all of you know, the biggest factor in climate change is carbon dioxide, the increasing amount of it in the atmosphere due primarily to burning fossil fuels. And although some countries have reduced their use of fossil fuels over the last few years, that's including the United States, much of that has been due to the slowdown in economic activity and probably is not permanent. We are not making progress either at the international level or domestically nearly fast enough. And the fact is that much of the damage is already irreversible, for the carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere will stay there for at least 100 years, possibly much longer, continuing to trap ever-increasing amounts of heat. Carbon dioxide, however, is not the only substance in the atmosphere that's contributing to global warming. There are also what are called the short-lived climate forcers, a set of gases and particulate matter that add their share. One of these, which scientists have come to appreciate only in the last few years, is black carbon. Some of you may not have heard too much about black carbon, so I'm going to take a minute here to explain in very general terms what it is and why it's important. Black carbon is, for most practical purposes, what you and I call soot. To be a little more precise, if not scientifically exact, it's the black part of soot. It's the dark component in the smoke from forest fires and from grass fires. In the developed world, most black carbon, most soot, comes from emissions from diesel engines. In the developing world, the greatest sources of black carbon are kerosene lamps and rather primitive cooking stoves. But black carbon is now recognized as being second only to carbon dioxide in its capacity to trap heat. And in fact, a new study issued last month says that it has the heat keeping capacity about two-thirds of that of carbon dioxide. So black carbon is a big factor in global warming. Now, unlike carbon dioxide, which forms an invisible blanket in the atmosphere that prevents the outward radiation of heat reflected from the Earth's surface, and is frankly a little hard to understand, there's nothing difficult to grasp, really, about black carbon. Anyone who has climbed into a black car that's been parked in the sun will understand why black carbon in the atmosphere is a problem. The darkness traps the heat. But it has other interesting properties as well. First, of course, it's not a gas, but a collection of minute particles with more mass that don't hang around in the atmosphere for very long. Spiraling wind patterns in the northern hemisphere carried them to the Arctic, where they fall onto the snow, glaciers, and sea ice, and continue to have their warming effect like billions of little tiny black rocks. By melting the sea ice, They in turn expose ever more dark seawater and land to sunlight, which further accelerates warming. This is one of the reasons why the Arctic is experiencing warming at a rate so much faster than the rest of the world. But unlike Las Vegas, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. A warming Arctic contributes to the warming of the rest of the Northern Hemisphere and also appears to destabilize weather patterns. And it will get worse if the Arctic warms to a point that it releases large volumes of methane, another powerful agent of climate change, from frozen permafrost and seabeds. But there's really some really good news about black carbon, too. As I mentioned, it tends to fall out of the atmosphere pretty quickly. Unlike carbon dioxide, which may stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years, and methane, which remains in the atmosphere for over a decade, black carbon falls to Earth within a matter of a couple of weeks. After that, it is no longer heating the atmosphere. Where it falls on ice or snow, as in the Arctic, it is generally covered by the next seasonal snowfall, and its warming effect is also largely eliminated there. In other words, if we could cut back on soot emissions, you should very soon see some positive benefits in the form of a slower rate of global warming. That doesn't mean that we could relax our efforts to fight carbon dioxide emissions. We have to do that a lot and as soon as possible. But we would hold some of the worst impacts of climate change at bay for a little longer while we work on the carbon dioxide problem and while we prepare our low-lying communities for the warming that is already in the pipeline. So we now have an opportunity. Rather unexpectedly, this was not foreseen 10 years ago, to do something about climate change. Not enough, but a good start. But will the anti-environmental, anti-science position of the Republican Party, combined with the filibuster, gerrymandered districts, political money, and a host of other abuses, prevent us from taking advantage of it? Will it slip through our fingers? I don't know the answer. I'm not sure I want to know. But there are some signs for a little hope. First, as I pointed out, black carbon is pretty easy to understand. People get it without having to understand the wavelengths of reflected energy. No one will argue that it's not pollution. The argument has existed for some time, well, carbon dioxide's not pollution, it's been around forever, it's a natural substance. But we know, the laws say, the politicians know, soot is pollution. It also has public health consequences. So any investment in reducing black carbon is sort of a twofer. You improve health, public health, and get that return on your investment, regardless of what you think about climate change. The technology for dealing with black carbon already exists. We're doing all sort of diesel emissions reductions programs, have been doing them all over the country for several years. Some of them take place right here in Portland. There have been grants from the EPA under a program called the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act, and they have been installing emissions controls on trucks that use I-5, on boats on the Columbia River, on school buses and public transportation. We can do that. We also know how to get better cook stoves, and we also know how to replace kerosene lamps something well. This is not new technology. It also doesn't put anybody out of business the way carbon dioxide does. It cleans things up. Actually, the trucking industry is a big supporter of the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act. I don't know exactly why that is. I suspect they like the idea that the government is helping you pay for installing this equipment, and that makes it more attractive rather than just having a government mandate that you do it instead. But whatever the reason it is, the trucking industry has been a very strong supporter of congressional appropriations for the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act, which leads me to another point about that act, which is one of the most intriguing of all. One of the biggest climate deniers in the United States Senate is James Inhofe, the senator from one of the senators from Oklahoma. He frankly believes that climate change is a hoax. He is a big supporter, however, of funding for the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act, because he views that as an effective program for controlling soot, controlling pollution, and protecting public health. In 2010, he actually co-sponsored with Barbara Boxer of California the legislation to fund the DERA program for another 5 years. He also believes that we should be working with countries in Africa and elsewhere to reduce emissions, because he sees them as a public health problem in those parts of the world. And of course, he's a devout Christian and engaged in missionary activity, and he's made a lot of trips to Africa, so he actually knows what the impacts are there. So we have big bipartisan support right now for a small domestic program to reduce diesel emissions. We also have, thanks to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and I wish you were staying around for this reason, the U.S. has taken a leadership role in putting together what's called the Climate and Clean Air Coalition, a group of now, I think, 60 or 70 countries that are committed to working together to see how they can achieve reductions in black carbon emissions without having to go through things like the Kyoto Protocol and all of that, of just getting to work on the problem. So there are some things here that I think are pretty promising. And in an ordinary political environment, I think it would be almost a sure thing that we could take more action to reduce diesel emissions, to fund programs overseas for replacing stoves, replacing kerosene lamps, working with other countries. It's in our interests. It gives us public health. I'm not sure in this political climate and with the sort of position that the Republican Party has kind of gotten itself into at this point, whether it's going to be able to make that step. But we should all be doing everything we can to explain, to learn about the black carbon problem, to talk to our neighbors and friends, talk to our politicians, local and national, about it. Because if we're not doing everything we can to get the United States to do everything it can, future generations will never forgive us. Thank you.
You're listening to a live remote broadcast of KBOO Portland is what you're listening to. We have been listening to Buck Parker, and we are going to have a Q&A. He is now being gifted a blanket by the president of Hillary. Please stay tuned for Q&A.
Come back and put it on a bed up in Hood River shortly.
Well, thank you very, very much. Really appreciate that. That's very, very kind. Very appreciated. So let's open it up now. And I don't know how long the question and answer period usually last, but I'm sure we have 15 or 20 minutes here if we want to, and I will try to try to call on you when I can see through the light.
Thank you, Buck, very much. Glad you're back, and we have a long list of items that we're going to need your help on once you do get moved here. In the meantime, could you, I think you alluded to it a little bit, but hit a little bit on who owns our environment?
Well, I mean, I'm not one for rhetorical questions. I treat that, though, as the question of who has the who influences environmental decisions the most. And that changes from time to time. Obviously, the resource extracting companies of one sort or another have the most direct and visible effect on the environment. But an awful, and you know, so in the past it's been from time to time, timber companies, mining companies, oil companies. We all know the sort of the litany of money and politics and the vested interests. One of the things we don't know is just how many subsidies are already out there. You know, once an industry manages to get itself subsidized in some way, either by whether it would be a below-cost timber sale or low mining royalties or something like that, that subsidy goes on forever. It seems to be the one thing that the only thing the two parties can agree upon is that to continue the subsidies for their constituents. So, you know, the resource companies have the most profound effect, but air polluters, water polluters, much of the history of environmental law actually over the last three decades has been trying to force the internalization of those costs. And by doing that, you actually do return the air or the water more to the public sphere. But it requires constant investigation and constant vigilance.
Thank you so much for that, Mr. Parker. It's wonderful to hear you speak tonight, and thanks, of course, to the Ilahi Institute for making this happen. My question is, to what extent has the dismantling of the public education system and the anti-intellectual streak on both the left and the right contributed to anti-environmentalism and the creeping privatization of higher research and higher institutions of higher education?
Thank you. I think that's a really good question. I don't know of, you know, sort of studies that might have quantified that in some way. But it certainly is clear that much of what I've been talking about is essentially part of an anti-intellectual streak that has always had some appeal in American politics, but seems to be much greater now. One hopes has approached its zenith. And I do worry about public education. It's not a field in which I have worked or been involved, but clearly the best way to immunize or inoculate society from untruth is a good, sound education that includes a strong scientific background and appreciation for science as well.
I have a two-part question. The first is, I'm wondering if you could elaborate on the black particulate matter that you're talking about, and whether coal, you didn't mention about coal, so I'm particularly interested in coal and China's use of coal and if that's a factor. And then the second thing, if you bear with me, is I believe that there is an issue in China with coal and electricity. So I've been in a quandary in my thinking in terms of what the solution is domestically and in China in terms of whether nuclear or natural gas, which of course we know has problems, which type of alternative solutions can we look towards in terms of providing electricity for China as well as the U.S.?
Well, I mean, it's a good and complex question. I'll just try to be short with some things. One, the coal question is a really that's a very good question. One of the things that I didn't get into, because I didn't want to get into the weeds, and I don't want to go into something that's a lot farther than I understand it, but there are white components to soot as well. And one of the things that happens very often is that both black and white particulates are produced by burning coal or burning other things. And the white emissions actually have a beneficial effect, potentially, on global warming because they reflect more light outward. But the reason that I didn't mention coal is that the big problem with coal, the biggest problem, particularly in the developing world, developed world, is the carbon dioxide emissions. We've cleaned up our coal burning pretty well. It's not, in the developed countries, a major source of soot. It is a bigger source in China and other places, but they are working to clean them up, too. There's a lot of pressure just to do it as a matter of public health. I should also add, on the question of China, China and India are both very concerned about black carbon. They may be more aware of it than we are, because it tends to settle closer to its source. And it's settling on the Himalaya, and they're losing their snowpack and glaciers at an alarming rate, and that's where all of their water comes from. So that's one of the issues around coal. As to where to go, just have to remember, there's a lot we don't know about what's going on in China. Our news coverage isn't all that great. It was in the news last week that China is considering imposing a carbon tax as a way to try to lower some of their emissions. And China it may have natural gas. I don't know what its natural gas supplies are. It has coal. It doesn't have enough coal. It really wants that U.S. coal. But, they're also making a huge investment in renewable energy and solar and wind in China. They know they have a problem.
Well, I'm the director at Friends of the Columbia Gorge, and so my question was exactly going to be about coal. And the question, that we're looking at is a lot of times, and I know you've dealt with this in lawsuits, sometimes delay is your friend. And in this case, I'm just curious about your perspective with China, if you do have insights beyond what the people in this room have, about how quickly they can make a turn. Can they turn on the dime more because they are such a centralized country with billions of dollars to move quickly? And so,
I'm not an expert on China, but the conventional wisdom is that China will be able to deal with these problems a lot faster than the United States or India, simply because it's not a democracy. Yeah. And once the powers that be make up their mind that this has to be addressed or feel threatened by it. There's much about global warming is very threatening because it affects food supplies and water supplies, and suddenly you get restive populations. And a restive population in China is not a good thing for the Communist Party. So they're facing that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. First, I want to mention I'm a libertarian environmentalist. Those two viewpoints are not opposed.
Good.
But the question is on peak oil. What impact is peak oil going to have on global warming? Is it going to make it worse or better? That seems like another freight train coming at us.
Okay. I think peak oil, it has good and bad. And that is, for the theory, and I think it's more than that. At some point, we're going to run out of oil. And at some point, production will peak and it will fall, and there are some who argue that that's already starting to happen. Now, the good thing about that is that as that happens, prices will go up, and people will start looking at alternative forms of energy and things that appear to be, renewables that appear to be too costly now, perhaps, will be cheaper in comparison, and that will help drive a change. Now, the bad thing is that about peak oil is like peak almost anything, is that it really drives efforts to develop oil in places where you actually, which are really environmentally risky. That's what we have going on right now in the Arctic. There are a hell of a lot safer places to drill for oil than in the Chukchi or Beaufort Sea. But as oil deposits are played out in other places, companies are really going to want in there. And we, you know, you see the same things happening in logging, where they cut along the valley floor, but later on, when they've taken all of that, they're going onto the steep slopes and you get landslides and things like that. Anytime that happens and you have a set industry entrenched to develop a resource, the damage they do is likely to get worse as you run out of that at the individual site.
Yes. Cap and trade was a successful mechanism for controlling sulfur dioxide pollution early in the Clean Air Act. But as it's been applied to carbon dioxide and global warming gases, it's had its troubles, especially in the European Union and REGI at first, given the inability to set effective cap levels and with the problem of loopholes like offsets. Do you think cap and trade is the right tool or mechanism, or is it the only tool for our carbon dioxide regulatory approach?
I mean, it's not the only tool. Cap and trade is considered the market-friendly tool, and that allows for trading, and it allows you, in theory, to get the most reductions the cheapest and the fastest. But there are two other systems would be a carbon tax, which would simply impose a straightforward cost on any emitter of carbon. Or another one would be to do it through regulation and just clamp down on it. I myself was always drawn to the idea of a carbon tax, as I thought it sounded to me, at least, that it would be simpler to implement. And if there is one thing that governments know how to do, it is tax. And that might get us there a little bit faster. Frankly, I would support any and all of the above. Right now, we're going to be left for a while with, you know, regulation, EPA, and just direct regulation. And thank God we have that, and thank God that we did get a court interpretation that EPA has the authority under the Clean Air Act to treat carbon dioxide as a pollutant, or we would be really up a creek. But right now, it's more toward regulation we're going. Either a carbon tax or a cap and trade system will require federal legislation.
A large portion of your talk focused on the Republican Party's reticence to pass any environmental legislation in recent years. And I was wondering if first you thought that was more out of because of lobbying groups or because of attempts at voter retention. And second, if it's predominantly for voter retention, do you think that we'll see them changing their minds on that issue similar to their change on immigration in recent years as they see it become more important in elections?
I made the comment to someone today at lunch that if you wanted to get the fastest action on climate change, discover that it is very important to Latino voters. And it may be. Frankly, that's a constituency that has been ignored. I think most of what has happened has been driven by money and lobbying efforts. But I do think that, as I tried to outline, that this has turned out to play well with certain constituencies that the Republicans are courting. I'm not, a great fan of a lot of Democrats myself, and maybe I'm going at this as, maybe I talk about it so much as the lover scorned. I originally registered in 1966 when I turned 21. I'll be turning 68 for those of you who are doing the math. I registered as a Republican. You had people like Tom McCall on the political scene. It didn't seem strange to me at all. It was only later that I felt, Barry Goldwater had already happened. I treated that as an aberration. But later I decided I didn't leave the Republican Party so much as I felt it left me.
So why was our response to the problems with the ozone layer so different than our response to global warming? And was it the times or was it the nature of the problem? And one way to answer that question would be to speculate about what you think we would do now with the ozone problem if we were just discovering it.
I wasn't involved in a little story. A few years ago, I found myself on a river rafting trip in Idaho with Tim Wirth and his wife. People on the rafting trip talked about things of interest to them, and I talked about global warming. And I really took to task cap and trade as a system of dealing with it, and strongly was arguing that it ought to be a carbon tax. I didn't know that Tim Wirth considered himself the author of the cap and trade system. There was an uncomfortable moment there when it suddenly dawned on me what I had just said. Some things I know that are different. One is there were substitutes available, refrigerants and such at the time, so it was easier to make the move than it may be with carbon dioxide. I also have the impression that there were a smaller number of players involved, and the carbon dioxide market is going to be vast, and that may make it more complicated. But I don't know more than that, and I may be wrong. You look up.
So your answer is that it was because it's an easier problem.
It may well be an easier problem to address.
We seem to get all these commercials telling us how clean natural gas is, and we have this abundance that we're getting out of the ground by fracking. Can you share with us any insights as far as the forces at work in that ecology that we're dealing with?
I just don't frankly believe that natural gas is all that cleaner when you take into account everything that goes into the production of it and the fracking itself. I admit Earth Justice has a lot of lawyers challenging fracking decisions all over the country, so that may bias me. I think that you have to step back in the long run and say, let's not focus quite so much so immediately on bridge values. Let's talk about where we want to go in the long term. And in the long term, we want to go to renewables. We don't want to make a big investment in infrastructure just for something that's a bridge to something else. It's better off to put the money into investing in the infrastructure for what you want to get to ultimately. So my notion is that I'm very skeptical about natural gas as a substitute fuel, or the idea that it will simply be around as a bridge. I think it will actually keep us from crossing over to the other side that much longer.
Well, thank you all for coming tonight. We'll look forward to seeing you.
You just finished listening to a live remote broadcast of a Ilahi lecture. That was Buck Parker that just finished talking to us about who owns the environment. I'm Del Crescenzo, and I am here with...
I'm Jimmy Tardy. Yes, that's right. We were just listening to Buck Parker. His Ilahi lecture series piece, Who Owns Our Environment? They're just closing up now. The crowd of at least a couple hundred people that came out tonight to listen to Buck talk about such things as the change in the tenor regarding environmental laws in our legislature in this country, and a couple of maybe clues for where to move forward in the future.
And the lecture continues next month. It's going to be March 19th, and we're going to have John Stuber, "Who Controls Our Media Is the Question." Next would be in April, Catherine Austin Fitz, "Who Owns Our Finances?" And the final of the lecture series would be Jeffrey Clements, that's in May, "Who Owns Our Government?" Well, we want to thank you for tuning in. You can listen to this program, if you missed it, kboo.fm. Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Del. And when you go to kboo.fm, if you'll search for Illahi, on there, you'll find you can download the previous lecture that was given by Raj Patel on January 23rd, his lecture, "Who Owns Our Food?" Tonight's lecture will be available for download as well. And KBOO, your community-supported radio station, will be covering the rest of this Illahi lecture series, which the overall title of the series is "Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It." Last year, Illahi examined several systems, among them democracy, economy, education, healthcare, and national defense. They highlighted those because it's pretty well established that those type of systems are resistant to criticism or change.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no longer just issues or complex problems to be solved, but those things, democracy, economy, education, healthcare, and national defense, have become commodified. And since it's now a money stream, that affects how people deal with those issues.
Absolutely. And you can go to illahi.org to learn more about Illahi the Institute and also their lecture series. And we want to encourage you to come out. Every time is a standing room only, and every time it is broadcasted, we broadcast live here on KBOO from the First Congressional Church. Next?
That's right. So just remember, the March edition of the Illahi Lecture Series is John Stauber, "Who Controls Our Media?" Mm-hmm. Something that the folks here at KBOO, we're going to be quite interested to hear what Mr. Stauber has to say. He's the founder of the Center for Media Democracy, an independent writer, organizer, and activist, co-authored 6 books, including "Toxic Sludge Is Good for You," "Trust Us, We're Experts," and a New York Times bestseller, "Weapons of Mass Deception," from 2003. You'll probably remember that title. It certainly rings true to me. Tickets are available at the illahi.org website. And again, we will be here live. That's going to be March 19th. It'll be held here once again in the sanctuary at the First Congregational Church in downtown Portland. And that's located on the Park blocks, the South Park blocks. And I think we're somewhere in the neighborhood of Madison.
Yeah, it's 1126 Southwest Park Avenue, if you want the exact address, right across the street from the Portland Art Museum.
Very easy to find, very easy to get to.
Yes. We are going to go back to the air. Stay tuned for Drinking from Puddles. Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland.
And I'm Jimmy Tardy.
Yeah, and I'm Del Crescenzo, host of Brian Roses.
KBOO Radio is a proud sponsor of the 23rd Cascade Festival of African Films, Africa Through African Lenses. The film festival will take place February 1st through March 2nd, 2013, Thursday through Saturdays each week. The majority of films were made by African directors and celebrate Africa's achievements, expose Africa's failures, and reveal the possibilities of change and a more hopeful future. More information on the Festival of African Films can be found at kboo.fm/CFAF23.
Hey, KBOO Portland. It's a little after 8:26 right now. My name is Brandon. Time for drinking from Puddles pastime, as I would say. A special, very special edition of the program tonight. If you consider yourself a potentially sensitive listener, drinking from Puddles not always recommended for those type of listeners, I suppose, till next week. And but if you are one tonight, please turn off your radio at this time. Rejoining KBOO Portland sometime in the future. Yeah, a slightly delayed edition of the show. Our last ever 3.5 hour show actually turns out to be at last 2.5 hour or so show, but a very, 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 very special one, as my live in studio guest later tonight will be Sally Ford and the Sound Outside. So sticking around listening for that. That's coming up. They'll probably start about 10 o'clock tonight. And in the meantime, got as much music that I can fit in, new music, old music. We're going to start with another track off the recently released EP, self-released EP by the band Glory, but G-L-O-R-I-E. And this song is the title track to their Falling EP. It's Glory. It's here for you on KBOO Portland, listener-supported radio and drinking from puddles. I'm Brandon. Sally Ford coming up later tonight. Thanks for tuning in.